Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Migration and Diaspora Podcast, a show about all things migration. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Ilana Wong to the show to talk about multi-stakeholder engagement in global migration governance. Now, let me tell you a little bit about Ilana. Ilana is a young advocate for migrant rights, as well as for civil and whole-of-society representation, currently serving as part of the Secretariat for the Civil Society Action Committee and Global Forum for Migration and Development Civil Society Mechanism, housed under the International Catholic Migration Commission, ICMC. She formerly served as co-director and Asia-Pacific regional lead for the Migration Youth and Children Platform, where she led youth participation in multiple migration advocacy processes at the global and regional processes, including the 2020 Global Compact for Migration Asia-Pacific Regional Review, the 2021 Global Forum for Migration and Development, and the 2022 International Migration Review Forum, as well as for cross-cutting international policy forums for UNESCO, the WHO, and the United Cities and Local Governance. Originally from Malaysia and Singapore, she currently resides here in the UK. In today's far-reaching conversation, Ilana and I discuss her work with the Civil Society Action Committee to engage in global migration governance processes like the Global Compact for Migration, the GCM. Ilana shares her perspectives on how the GCM, adopted at the end of 2018, has gone thus far from the perspective of civil society engagement and how the commitments to multi-stakeholder engagement that the GCM text enshrines compare with the realities of its implementation. Ilana also tells us how to enable meaningful multi-stakeholder engagement in global migration governance. I'm so glad to have Ilana on the show to update us on this topic after her colleague and legendary civil society activist Colin Raja came on the show a couple of years back to share some really valuable insights. I'll link to that episode in the show notes and really recommend you tune into that one too. Anyway, I've waffled on for far too long. So without further ado, thank you very much for listening, and I hope you enjoy the show. Good afternoon, Ilana Wong. Welcome to the Migration and Diaspora Podcast. How are you, and where are you calling in from?
I'm good. Thanks so much, Loxanne. Thanks for having me. I've definitely listened to some of your podcast episodes before, so it's a big honor to be called upon. I'm calling in from London, so I don't think we're too far from each other, actually.
Exactly. We're about 60 miles away from each other. So I'm guessing the weather's about as rubbish your end as it is my end.
100%.
Exactly. So a good day for podcasting. Ilana, tell us a bit more. What's your own migration and diaspora story?
Mm-hmm. Yep, I can definitely tell you. I think it might not be too dissimilar from yours in some way, actually. So my grandparents are from different parts of China, which parts I cannot actually say because unfortunately 3/4 of them have passed on and they didn't tell me. But I believe that they are quite different parts of China, and they all in varying stages of their lives and different ages fled the communist revolution that was happening in China and migrated to what was then known as Malaya before the independence of Malaysia and Singapore. They spent their early years there, I think around sort of childhood to teenagers, depending on what age they were. And then my parents themselves were born in Malaysia and Singapore, respectively. I grew up most of my time in Malaysia. I went to sort of boarding school in Singapore, so I think you could call that kind of growing up there too. And I moved to the UK for university when I was 18. And since then have stayed on, sort of bouncing around Europe a bit too. I had a year in Amsterdam, a year in Edinburgh, but largely in the UK. So I would consider myself a migrant to the UK, or at least a member of the Malaysian-Singaporean diaspora.
Okay, well, would you consider yourself overseas Chinese or part of the Chinese diaspora as well?
You know, that's really strange. That's a really interesting question. I think that could be a whole other podcast, actually, episode about the perspectives and identities of overseas Chinese. I don't think I would say so because I think with that layer of Malaysian and Singapore in the middle between my Chinese heritage, I've only ever spent 1 month in China doing an internship. My Mandarin is absolutely terrible. My parents tend to speak a mixture of English and Cantonese at home anyway. And whilst I'm very interested in Chinese history and we take elements of the heritage, I don't feel any personal connection to the homeland as it is.
Fair enough. You celebrate Chinese New Year?
Yes. automatically a mandatory. I think it's mandatory for all of us.
Yeah, okay, very interesting. And I also, before getting into the topic at hand, I also wanted to ask you just a little bit about your career trajectory for two reasons. One, you're one of the younger guests that we've had. And as I've mentioned to you in the past, I've guest lectured a lot on migration to master's degree students. And people are always coming up to me after the lectures to ask, how do I make a career in the field of migration? And I'm always quite short of ideas because my trajectory was very random. So I wanted to at least share your own random trajectory as well. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, 100%. I would say I started off with an interest in migration without necessarily being conscious of it. The privilege of going to a high school called United World College, where there was a big focus on community service and impact, particularly both at a local level and a global level. So this notion of giving back to the community, working on these issues that affect people's rights and protection around the world was embedded into me from quite a young age. And as I went throughout university, I actually studied first English literature. And then did a master's in sociology. I was always interested in this like political aspect of movement, of identity, especially as I think as I became a bit more aware of my own and the contradictions within it. But I was very drawn to film, literature, migration patterns, and like this sort of organically came about as being an interest. And then when I did my master's at Edinburgh, that was during the, in quotations, the refugee crisis that was happening in Europe. And I got very involved in the into a grassroots collective action, trying to promote integration, community building, and promoting understanding and connections between both the Edinburgh local community as well as the refugees who are being resettled there. And from there, I sustained an interest in this space, albeit from sort of a grassroots community perspective. And I had a first job in the completely random sort of tech consultancy, which taught me a lot in terms of professional conduct, in terms of project management. But I sort of brought some of the feeling to that too. I started with a couple of other colleagues, the Diversity and Inclusion Program. Having been the first migrant, actually the first non-UK national to work in that company, I felt it was important to try and open up those doors more, promote inclusivity and further understanding. And then during COVID, it was actually when I started, I would say in quotation, started my migration career journey, where I got involved with this organization called the Migration Youth and Children Platform, then which was it was called the Major Group for Children and Youth Migration Working Group. But they were in the midst of about to input into the Bali process meeting, which was the then like a regional process of for migration governance in the Asia Pacific region. And then following from that, the Asia Pacific GCM, or Global Compact for Migration Regional Reviews. So I got kind of thrown into a deep end there, where I was coordinating first in the Asia Pacific region youth engagement into these processes. I didn't actually know much about them at all. When I first started, I was supposed to join a team that was with other people who had done these processes before as youth, but they for personal reasons had to drop out. So I had to learn very quickly, and I think have to really lean on many different people, both youth who've been in this space before, as well as civil society leaders, contacts in the UN who were all very supportive. And that was when I started at this completely voluntary group, then elected to the co-director position, which was the global lead, where I was putting youth into these spaces and facilitating youth engagement for the IMRF, the International Migration Review Forum, and other global governance. Yeah. From there, that was a 2-year mandate as a co-director, keeping in mind that this is all voluntary as well, because youth engagement is very underfunded. But from there, I was very lucky to then finish my mandate with being offered a job at ICMC, the International Catholic Migration Commission, which houses the civil society equivalent civil society platform for inputs into these global migration governance processes. So yes, in some ways, I would say I've just started my career in migration being paid, but in other senses, I think it's been a while as well.
Yeah, no, what a fantastic journey. And that reminds me, I said there were two reasons why I was asking you the question. And the second reason was just to show how there was that clear civil society advocacy theme that was running throughout those different stages, which is really interesting. And let's get on to the topic at hand. And we're going to talk all about the role and the work of the Civil Society Action Committee, especially as regards how you input into these global forums and mechanisms on global migration governance. Before that, I just wanted to remind listeners that we did interview your colleague, the legendary Colin Raja, the coordinator of the Action Committee, a couple of years ago. It was episode number 16 of the Migration and Diaspora podcast. So we will leave a link to that in the show notes. It was a wonderful conversation and we learned a lot, but that was also a couple of years ago. And so this episode is in some ways a sequel, an update, a refresher, and excited to get your take, Ilhan, on all the things that have been going on, especially because I feel a couple of years ago, the Global Compact for Migration was still seen as somewhat new, but now it's had time to bed in 5 years on. Just to timestamp this, this is November 2023. So I think we've got a lot more to talk about now. So let's get into that. And let's just start by talking about what is your role at the Civil Society Action Committee and what does the Civil Society Action Committee do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. So my official title is called Policy Officer, but I think that doesn't really encompass what we do. We work a lot on policy and advocacy, and we basically serve as the secretariat for the Civil Society Action Committee, as well as for the civil society mechanism facilitative capacity for the Global Forum for Migration and Development. What we do is we essentially serve as a conduit between these processes and the processes secretariats of their organizational teams, between that and civil society itself. I think many of us who come from civil society are very aware with how much work that goes on. There's both the grassroots programs, there's both the operational aspects, there's many different areas for advocacy as well. And following these global, especially governance processes, can be a full-time job in itself. There is so much information, there's very many different moving deadlines, moving parts, and it takes a lot to keep up with them. We try to alleviate some of that burden by serving as a liaison, as a facilitative platform to ensure that civil society gets this information, gets it accurately, are able to be put in touch with the right people, are able to also build capacity amongst themselves, both within the organizations, but also as a collective, to properly engage in a way that they will feel more heard, where they're able to provide relevant inputs, they're able to also target certain spheres of thematics or interests that are growing. We provide a lot of this information and this facilitative aspect of bringing people together for the purpose of inputting into a process. So that's in a gist what we do. Obviously, the day-to-day is a lot more nuanced and complicated, but that's the objective.
Right. And what is civil society? How do you actually define civil society?
Yeah, definitely. So civil society, I think this is actually leading into one of probably the later questions, which is, so what are the challenges that we face? But one of the issues and the most beautiful things about civil society is that there are many different definitions. So this is often also defined differently across many different spaces. And what it usually is it encompasses NGOs of all sizes, everything from, I would say, some of our members are big ones, International Detention Coalition, Save the Children, Oxfam, for instance, very big, well-known INGOs. But it also goes down to regional NGOs, grassroots NGOs as well, also community organizations, networks of different NGOs and different community organizations, coalitions too, also come into civil society, but also diaspora organizations, trade unions. These all come under, and I would say that they kind of encompass the third sector in the way of society, which is not government, which is not private sector, which is not these like established institutional authorities, but everyone inputting into the betterment or creation of society from these other areas of the community. So for example, in the GFMD, it also includes academia, but that doesn't necessarily track across many different processes.
Is media civil society?
That's a big question. In a way, it is, but at the same time, you would see that media doesn't really engage in this. So I think necessarily consider themselves part of civil society. So I think this is something that needs to be revisited, because we can't fully engage some aspects of the global structure, such as media, without expanding these concepts and without sort of redefining them in the public eye.
Last question about that. What about academia and faith-based organizations? Are they civil society?
Yes. So faith-based organizations definitely come under civil society. Academia oftentimes does under governance process definitions, but I don't think academia themselves really consider themselves civil society either, because they're not necessarily forming operations on the ground, which is what most definitions of civil society in people's minds relate to. But research, et cetera, is a very, very important component. And there are many different academics who are very active within the civil society community, for instance.
Yeah, I also asked this because in the GCM, in Article 44, They say we will implement the Global Compact in cooperation and partnership with migrants, civil society, migrant and diaspora organizations, faith-based organizations, local authorities and communities, private sector, trade unions, parliamentarians, human rights institutions, Red Cross, academia, media, and other relevant stakeholders, blah, 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 blah. So I asked that because I read that out because I thought a lot of these categories were also civil society, whereas it kind of implies that they're not. But it could just be an international agreement where they didn't really think about proper categorization.
Yeah, I could imagine that. I think that they wanted to just highlight those different types of stakeholders, which I think is very important. For example, migrant diaspora organizations, definitely part of civil society, but should be highlighted. But I think when it comes to, transferring that into the process, then that's where it becomes more complicated, how they create these buckets of stakeholders.
Yeah, cool. Well, let's get on to how you actually input into these sort of global migration governance processes. You know, what are the main processes or platforms that you're working on?
Yeah, so the main processes and platforms we work on, we primarily at the moment, I would say we work on the Global Forum for Migration Development, the GFMD. That's been a running one that has existed pretty much since the GFMD existed. A lot of our civil society leaders were amongst the first who inputted into the very, very beginnings of the GFMD, pushing for this intergovernmental international space to discuss migration issues, although it wasn't properly formalized until 2011. And then also the Global Compact for Migration, which I think many civil society who have been involved in the GFMD point as only really becoming possible due to the groundwork that the GFMD provided in normalizing discussions around migration. So those are our main two tracks. And I would say the Civil Society Action Committee is primarily concerned with the GCM, et cetera, et cetera, the plus plus on the side. And then obviously the GFMD Civil Society Mechanism focuses on the GFMD. So some of the other process we also input into, we engage with IOM at different levels, both on the ground, but also at the international level through their partnerships division and through their things like the international dialogues on migration that they run. We are also concerned of other international processes around migration rights and protection. So sometimes things will come up around ILO agreements or, for example, the recent appointment of a new special rapporteur for the human rights of migrants. That's something that we also discuss.
And I suppose two questions now follow. So one is about how you engage internally. So how you bring different civil society elements together, create spaces for them, come to consistent, coherent positions. And the other would then be, how do you then engage with these processes more concretely? So to start with the first point, how do you bring together all these extremely diverse voices, extremely diverse types of organizations coming from different countries, cultures, backgrounds, needs, interests, et cetera, et cetera? How do you enable that meaningful engagement that then leads to some sort of meaningful and common positions on things?
With the wonder of the internet. Well, I mean, I joke, but that it definitely, I don't think it would be possible without the modern technology that we have. But I think one of the ways that we build this platform is that there are many different alignments within civil society. And of course, there are differences. And I think we see that within sometimes the natural tensions or differences in position that come from within civil society. One part of being a member of this platform is that you embrace that there will be these differences and that you understand that people will come from many different aspects. But at the center of it is the acknowledgement and the prioritization that being greater in number and being collective is ultimately for the greater good than trying to dwell on these smaller differences that people have. I think we started off with this common understanding that when we were created as a Civil Society Action Committee, we understood the sort of might in numbers or the benefit of coming as this coalition of now the biggest platform of migration related, being the keyword there, civil society actors and across the world. I think there's been a lot of acknowledgement of that and people understand the need to be part of the collective, but we face many different issues that, like you said, of how we engage everyone from all parts of the world at all different levels. So I would say, in a sort of gist of how the process works, is that our action committee members are themselves massive organizations or networks that exist across different parts of the world. I've already given you some examples of the organizations, specifically like the International Detention Coalition, Terre des Hommes, etc., who are NGOs, and they then bring their own internal networks as well as external from different, for example, TDH offices, from different partners that they work with. They will engage the relevant people into the processes that we put forward, but they will likely come from the perspective of having an advocacy office that are the main focal points. So that's one kind. But the other, and just as important kind, is that we have networks themselves who are very, very involved. So some examples of Migrant Forum in Asia, PICUM, the platform for undocumented migrants and refugees, something like that in Europe, for instance, Alianza Americas, Bloque sobre Migración, and in Latin America, also the Pan-African Network on Migrant Diaspora, for instance. I'm getting some of these names wrong, so I apologize to everyone who's listening. No. But these are some of the examples of these networks that already exist, regional strong networks where many different organizations and coalitions of migrant collective communities, for instance, diaspora organizations, NGOs, have already come together at a regional level to say, hey, we need to work together on these issues. And from then we become that additional conduit of where they can access the global level. So there's like a many layered approach of everything from the international actors, and then their whole cascading waterfall network of regional, sub-regional, national and grassroots NGOs who all are invited to attend global consultations, who are invited to attend meetings. And we regularly run these open invitation, for example, discussions, webinars, consultations that try to engage everyone who wants to be engaged as much as possible.
And to put that sort of, to make that again a bit more concrete, if mm-hmm. I think about my local Chinese association in my town in England, how can they feed into what you do? Would that be through a UK-based conduit, which then feeds into the Europe forums that then feeds into you? Mm-hmm. Or how would that work?
Yeah, so I think first they can just reach out to us through our website, through our emails, and ask, is there already a regional network that makes sense? They oftentimes will know of one within their sphere of influence who they've interacted yeah. with different events, and we can then facilitate that connection if they don't have it already. Or if there's none that's representative of them will actually make sense, then they can also input directly into us. We do have some organizations which are much more local who also engage, but it depends also a lot on the appetite, because sometimes these much more local organizations will say, actually, I don't think we need direct access to these international platforms. We don't really have time to follow it ourselves. We're going to go through a network who will sort of synthesize the information for us. But it depends a lot on the appetite that they want to take on.
Okay, interesting. Okay, so let's move on to how you actually engage in practice at the global level. And first of all, can we just remind ourselves, why does this engagement actually matter? And I ask that question also because in my experience working with a lot of governments on migration, there's always a sense that you need to engage with civil society. It always seems to be a little bit, or it doesn't always, but it sometimes seems to be a little bit of an afterthought or sometimes a little bit of a nuisance. I'm not talking about from my perspective, but from the perspective of some governments, there's a sense that, okay, we need to do something with the civil society. So yeah, I just wanted to remind everyone why we're talking about this. So why does this matter?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And I really appreciate the chance to plug this, that we talk about it and all the different platforms and processes. But I think it comes down to a very simple understanding that a lot of people inherently know to be true, but sometimes forget when it comes to putting programs into place, for instance. But is that you can't really ensure migrant that a program or a process or that a policy will actually work for migrants if you don't have them inputting into the design of it themselves, or if you don't have them inputting into the monitoring and evaluation, for instance. It's because a policy or a program, a plan can sound very good, can look fantastic on paper, can maybe even be good in implementation. But without having that perspective that you do as a migrant yourself, as someone who is literally sitting there waiting for their visa, who is trying to navigate a difficult asylum process in a language that is not your second or even your third, maybe for yourself and your mother who doesn't even read, maybe, or for even the more privileged migrants like myself, looking at the mountain of paperwork that you have to get through to go through a visa process or to apply for health insurance, to access my local education system. Without having that experience, you don't really know what it feels like. And you don't really understand all the multitude of challenges that can come from trying to engage in a process where if you are a policymaker who has had both the interest in it, but who has grown up in the country their whole lives, and maybe has even moved around, has lived in different places, but who's not faced those specific barriers, then it's very hard to design something that works for everyone, or at least opens the doors for people to come back and say, hey, this is not working for me. So I think that when it comes down to it, it's really in the principle that representation is necessary for effectiveness.
Yeah, nothing about us without us, etc.
Exactly.
And let's talk a bit more about the GCM and how you've engaged on that and how civil society engagement has worked. We're, what, about 5 years on from the GCM being concluded, and also remind listeners of one important aspect of the Global Compact, which is the guiding principle of the whole of society approach, in which the GCM says that the GCM promotes broad multi-stakeholder partnerships to address migration in all its dimensions by including migrants, diasporas, local communities, civil society, academia, the private sector, parliamentarians, trade unions, national human rights institutions, the media, and other relevant stakeholders in migration governance. So tell us, first of all, how has the GCM gone from your perspective?
Yeah, so I will caveat by saying as well that I will speak primarily from my own experience, but I will try to bring in also the collective ones that I have from engaging with civil society and many different stakeholders. And I'll try to nuance where it's me and where it's the coalition that I often represent. Because the perspectives are very diverse. And I think it matters a lot on what level you're engaging, in what country, to what degree as well. Because some people come in with very targeted objectives, like I really want to input into this specific objective around services, or I really want to end child detention, which I can't believe is still an ongoing issue. But obviously there are others where representation across migration policies, across migration governance and the creation of them is the goal. And so I think people's perspectives and experiences will differ a lot depending on these objectives. In terms of the way that we've input it into the GCM so far, we were very active at the IMRF and there was a lot of civil society preparation. We do something called Civil Society Preparatory Day for a lot of these processes where we collectivize a lot of people. We bring the delegates from civil
society. Also, do you want to just, I think a lot of listeners will know what the IMRF is, but do you want to just perhaps give a quick side note to those who might not?
Yes, of course. Yeah. Side note, the International Migration Review Forum is the first, well, it was the first, now it will be going second, global review of the Global Compact for Migration. So that comes 2 years after what's called the RMRF, or the Regional Migration Review, and is supposed to be a global stock taking in a sense of the progress of the GCM thus far.
Right. Continue.
No worries. But yeah, so civil society has engaged in the GCM from the beginning. As you know, you were there actually before I was. But in terms of for this recent International Migration Review Forum, there was a lot of civil society preparation in terms of consultations, collective meetings, national and regional consultations held by the networks and our platform, for instance. And then there was a civil society preparatory day on the 15th of May before the forum itself happened. And this is where we collectivize everyone's priorities, bring the whole civil society delegation together as well, not just to make connections, but also to bring their diverse perspectives, examples, priorities to the table and say, does this resonate with you? Which is a very important part of the work that we do. Then that went into what was the multi-stakeholder hearing that was held before the IMRF, and I believe will continue to be held before each GCM-related governance day or governance process. Where this was a space that the UN network had created so to ensure stakeholders were able to be the vast majority of those in the room to provide stakeholder perspectives. And so this was not just civil society, but mayors, business, many others as well. And then we were also present at the IMRF, both as participants or observing, but also as speakers, panelists, etc., both in the main summit program as well as inside events. So in terms of how it's going,
yeah, that background, I mean, it sounds like a lot of civil society engagement, you know,
it all sounds
great. So to what extent did that correspond to the spirit of that whole of society approach, how it should work on paper?
Yeah, of course. So I think this actually comes into, sort of like a big challenge where there's a lot of effort now being put in to engage civil society, both in terms of having spaces made like the multi-stakeholder hearing, for instance, having platforms like Us Engage where we do these collectivization efforts, as well as putting it out there on social media, on websites. The more people know about this, the more people want to engage. So in terms of the excitement for it, public awareness, that's going well, I think. And I think that the UN network have done a good job to try and make the GCM understanding of it more accessible. It's being taught in classroom. It's been created into an SDG-like infographic. I don't know if you've seen that, but I think there's a lot of effort being made to make it an accessible thing to understand and to try and see how it's relevant to you. Where I think it's still struggling, and we saw this a lot at the IMRF, is that the actual whole of society implementation is currently, I think, still facing many, many barriers, primarily because there's an inherent paradox or a contradiction between having a space that's created by governments for governments, like the UN, for instance, where the priority is still on making sure governments feel comfortable to engage, on giving the space for governments to essentially provide their progress, but in relation to many of the criticisms both before and current of the UN that we see, the UN seems to rely on its power in terms of having state buy-in. And so governments, if they don't necessarily want to be criticized or be held to account, they can also use it as a space to just talk about the good things and not really acknowledge the bad. And so because the governments are still sort of concerned of creating a space like that where government comfort and government agendas come first, when it comes to having stakeholders who are actually in the room to be there to be as equal members of the conversation or inputting meaningfully into these progress reports, progress declarations, sometimes it can be a bit of a nuisance to have someone saying, actually, that policy is not going so well, or actually on the ground, our members are saying that the policy is there, the law is there, but because of xenophobia, your police task force, your immigration authorities, your service providers aren't providing that care because of xenophobia. So I think that has become a bit of a paradox in itself, where the intention is there, but the execution is not, because of that, I would say, still lack of political will to be truly held to account, but also because the spaces that have been created, they've shoehorned stakeholders in as much of a way as I think that they really can at the moment without proper institutional reform. But in terms of things like, for example, the progress declaration that came out of the IMRF, that was being negotiated in a government-only process months in advance, and it was adopted at the IMRF. But in terms of for civil society and other stakeholders to input into that, they weren't actually allowed to say, hey, we want to comment on it directly. We want to provide our input. Everyone had to go through governments that they knew and say, could you mind putting in this language? And can we align on our priorities here? And can you point it out for us in discussions? So that one key aspect of the IMRF is, I wouldn't say is whole of society because of the way that it is prioritized and the way that it's been designed. Another way that there was issues was that there's a lack of physical space in the room, and there's also still logistical barriers like visas, like the cost of visiting New York, for instance, where it was being held, where it creates these inherent barriers that if you're not anticipating them and not specifically designing a process to go around them, becomes exclusive in nature.
Yeah, and also just to something that you said that made me think of some recent work I've been doing at the GCM level is, you know, states submit these voluntary, I can't remember the name of them,
voluntary
these voluntary,
national reviews,
voluntary national reviews to the IMRF. And they are essentially, I mean, I understand that some of the processes for developing them did involve civil society stakeholders, but the final submissions are developed by government officials. And the ones that I've read where I know a bit about the countries who wrote them, I didn't think they really reflected the realities of how they were implementing the GCM, in the sense that they were very one-sided, presenting some of the good things that government were doing or supposedly doing. And those could have benefited from the other side of the story or some more accountability. It's a bit like countries marking their own homework.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
So how would you improve this process and the system? I mean, could you have, I don't know, this is probably an idea that just comes to mind, is could you have civil society developing some national reviews, mm-hmm. or, you know, proposing a civil society review? What would you propose going forwards?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. So I think one of the
beyond, of course, some of the obvious things like giving some more money so that the civil society can get visas and so on to get to New York. In terms of process, what could be done?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course. So I think, and sorry that this is not necessarily process related, but I think it does come down to, like you said, the marking their own homework, which I think is the perfect analogy, is that there needs to be political will to have this put in place first. And I think as long as multilateralism continues to be what it is, where there's a, a great deal of lip service, I would say, to human rights, to many of these global principles, but there's not too much political will to properly uphold them and uphold them in a way that's meaningful and reflects the reality on the ground. This will be a difficult thing to propose reforms for. But in terms of specific recommendations or specific ideas on how it can be improved from where we stand, I would say funding definitely is one, but I'm going to add more detail to it and say that it has to be flexible and predictable, multi-year, for instance, because one of the issues that we see beyond just visas and the cost of getting there is that civil society and migrant organizations can't engage and can't provide the resource to engage unless they have safety of living, for example, or they have the resources to actually provide their time and the energy and their resources to collect their data, to attend the meetings, to spend the time to apply for to attend these things, for instance. And I can say that also from my own experience, where when I was leading my CP, the Migration Youth and Children Platform, I had to quit my job for 6 months to input into IMRF to ensure any kind of youth delegation was present. I literally could not have another job. And if I didn't have the privilege I have of having had stable job security before, being able to have savings to live off for that time, we probably wouldn't have had a youth delegation there. I think this is something that is actually a really crucial issue, because it's not only the attending the event itself, but it's the possibility of even preparing for it, possibility of even knowing about it, that is dependent on funding. So there's that, but then there's also the co-designing and co-creating of avenues and modalities for engagement with civil society and migrant organizations at all levels. So like you said, having the voluntary national reviews, which are great, but it would be wonderful if the UN network wanted to give a bit more guidance on how governments should do that, if they were able to also release guidance, but also say that, hey, if civil society organizations, if those on the ground want to provide additional voluntary reviews for their local region, for their country, you're welcome to do so, and we'll take that into consideration as well. There needs to be this equal weighting of voices, not just governments, who are incredibly important and should be allowed to talk about the issues they have, the policies that they've implemented, and the progress they've made, but should also have equal weighting beyond UN agencies to the communities, to the grassroots, to civil society as well. And then there's also the aspect of participation, where they do have these regional reviews, for instance, and a lot of the avenues for engagement currently are created by people who are stressed and who are organizing these massive events with not too much time and probably not too much guidance, or they do have guidance, but it changes from year to year what the needs are. We can see that reflected in the way that the processes themselves are designed. Deadlines are very short. There's a lot of criteria that you need to pass, and it doesn't really allow for preparation processes. It doesn't really allow for people who can actually only engage on the weekends, for instance. So I think that there needs to be more inclusion of civil society and migrants in the design of those avenues already. Then these also need to be clearly communicated in language that people understand at all levels and with far enough in advance warning, which currently is also doesn't happen. And then also looking at some of the structural barriers to this. So, for example, language accessibility. If you only have the guidelines or the forms in English, French, and Spanish, the people who speak Arabic, the people who speak their local languages will not be able to input. Time zone accessibility. We see this all the time, where meetings and preparatory briefings are held at times which are very unfriendly to people from the Pacific Islands, who have to wake up at 3 in the morning to attend meetings, for instance. And then also things like physical accessibility, right? Are you providing for people who don't have access to the internet or who need help to access the internet? How about people who are hard of hearing, hard of sight, can't go into a place without a wheelchair ramp, for instance? So all these need to be taken into account. And you can only do that by having the multitude of diverse experiences who need to be there to actually be co-creating it with you. And if I can add one last thing, I'm sorry, but I think
Yes.
this also, yeah, comes under the umbrella of being able to embed and embrace the concept of real meaningful engagement, the nothing for us without us, like you said. And it means actually shifting the mindset away from it being, oh, we need to engage civil society, what can we do to add them on? But actually embedding it and saying, actually, it's necessary for migrant and diaspora civil society organizations, for the community to engage because they're diverse, because they bring expertise, because they deserve to be here and to have this fundamental equal status into the process. Yeah.
Wow, what a very interesting and extremely useful list, I would say, of ways to improve this process. And also, I'd like to just flag that the Civil Society Action Committee published an IMRF assessment paper, which we can link to in the show notes, which will also give listeners a bit more insights and some more detail into some of the ways in which the IMRF worked in terms of civil society engagement and ways it could be improved. Right. Well, we're having to bring this conversation to a close. I just wanted to ask you as well, what does your work plan for 2024 look like? Since listeners are probably hearing this at the beginning of 2024, what have you got on your agenda for this year?
Yeah, of course. So depending on when this gets published, but we may be already out or just in the last minute preparations for the GFMD, which is happening in January in Geneva. That's been a big one that we've been working on for the past few months. And then following from that, there will be some follow-up in terms of reports, in terms of debriefing, et cetera, how we also take the conversations forward, how we can establish or help encourage more of these collaborations between stakeholders and governments and civil society, of course. And then we'll be supporting our network members for the upcoming regional migration reviews and preparing for the International Migration Review Forum, which will be happening in not so long. So we definitely will be doing a lot of capacity building. I'd encourage anyone listening who's interested in engaging in the IMRFs, who are interested in even doing something like their own voluntary consultations, reviews of their countries or their regions, to reach out to us, engage. There will be a lot of opportunities too, and we're very happy to put you in touch with the relevant people or see how we can take your voice to the global level. That will be the work that we do, and we're looking at more ways to support civil society, more ways to try and bring meaning, purpose, and impact to the work that everyone does.
Very busy year ahead then. And so last but not least, how can listeners connect with you and learn more about the Civil Society Action Committee?
Yeah, of course, you can come to our website, which hopefully, Loxanne, you can link into the show notes as well. You can also email us. Our emails are all there, but you can also contact me on LinkedIn if you want to. I'm available under Alana Wong. I think if you Google me, or maybe it'll be linked into the show notes as well, you can find me. And yeah, very happy to chat to anyone. Very happy for you to look at the website that we have, and we hope to see you on a consultation or something like that soon.
Fantastic. Everything will be linked to in the show notes. Elana, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. And best of luck for the new year.
Thank you so much, Loxanne. Hope to see you in person sometime soon.
Thank you so much for tuning in to the Migration and Diaspora podcast, powered by Homelands Advisory, your independent migration and diaspora agency. If you've enjoyed the show and would like to support our channel, please feel free to share it or leave a review via your preferred podcasting platform. You can access the channel's full archive and show notes by visiting homelandsadvisory.com/podcast, where you can also get in touch if you'd like to be on the show. Thank you again, and see you next time.